Welcome to SCOTUSCast, State of the Affordable Care Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 28, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in National Federation of Independent Businesses v. Sebelius, along with the companion cases Department of Health and Human Services v. Florida and Florida v. Department of Health and Human Services. All these cases involve challenges to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Questions before the court included whether the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate is constitutional and whether the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicare improperly coerces the states. In an opinion delivered by the Chief Justice, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the individual mandate may be upheld as within Congress's power under the Taxing Clause. In addition, Justices Breyer and Kagan joined the Chief Justice in concluding that the Medicare expansion coerced the states in a manner violative of the Constitution. Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justice Sotomayor, did not agree with the coercion rationale, but did agree that Congress could not withhold existing funds based on a refusal to participate in the expansion. Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Thomas filed an additional dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Randy Barnett, who is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at Georgetown University Law Center, and Neil Ketchal, who is a partner at Hogan Lovells, Professor at Georgetown Law Center, and former Deputy Solicitor General. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Professor Barnett.
Hi, it's great to be here to discuss the decision in the NFIB versus Sebelius case. As I think everybody knows, since this is one of the most famous cases decided in our lifetime, this case concerned the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and in particular, two provisions of that act. First of all, the individual insurance mandate that required that all Americans purchase health insurance as a means to compensate insurance companies for the costs that were being imposed upon them by various restrictions or various requirements that were being placed upon them, like, for example, guarantee issue and community rating, which required that they issue policies for coverage despite pre-existing conditions and that their rates be adjusted accordingly. The individual mandate was a source of income for the insurance companies and was also supposedly aimed at cost shifting that took place between people who did not have insurance and did have insurance. The other provision of the act that was challenged was the Medicaid provisions, which was basically a pretty substantial change in the Medicaid program for which Congress was going to provide considerable additional funding for the new expanded Medicaid program. Naturally, it conditioned this new funding on states accepting this new expanded program, but it also reserved the right to condition funding for all existing Medicaid programs, and that was, in fact, the entire funding condition was challenged because it was alleged to be coercive, meaning that it would no longer be a free choice of the states to stay within the Medicaid program, but would, in fact, be coercion under the South Dakota versus Dole approach that said that at some point, an incentive becomes coercive and therefore is unconstitutional commandeering of states. So those were the two big issues on the table, and we did receive answers to these issues, and they weren't what anybody expected. I think everybody on both sides expected that if the Affordable Care Act was upheld, that it would be upheld under the Commerce Clause, in addition under the tax power. But if it was struck down, then the Commerce Clause theories or arguments the challengers were making would be accepted, and the government's objections would be rejected. So basically, it would be all or nothing at all. You would have the act upheld and the government of the case accepted, or you'd have the act struck down and the challenger's theory of the case accepted. That's what I think pretty much everyone expected, but that's not what we got. We got a very unexpected opinion from Chief Justice John Roberts as the swing vote, reasoning that wasn't joined either by the four liberals who concurred with him. Although they did formally join his reasoning, they didn't feel the need to do that. They did sign on to it, as well as four dissenting conservative justices. Basically, had John Roberts strongly affirming the Commerce Clause arguments that we had been making in the challenge from the beginning. First of all, that the commerce power is limited. Secondly, the courts will enforce those limits. And third, that the individual mandate exceeds those limits because it goes beyond the regulation of activity to the mandating or requiring of activity that would then be regulated. He accepted that argument in its entirety. He also accepted our argument that the Necessary and Proper Clause did not save the statute because however necessary it may well have been to the overall scheme of the Affordable Care Act, it was not a proper means of exercising Congress's power. So he accepted all that. But then he turned around and gave the statute, he said, because it was unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause, a necessary and proper clause, he gave the statute a limiting construction, what he called a saving construction, in which the mandate, the requirement part of the individual mandate was eliminated, but the penalty part, which was the consequence for not getting insurance, was retained, and he said the penalty part standing alone could be reconstrued to be a tax. It wasn't the best or natural reading of the statute, but he said it was a possible reading that could be reasonable, and therefore, under the obligation of the courts to uphold statutes where possible, he adopted the saving construction, which he said he wouldn't need to do if he could have upheld the entire mandate under the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause. So that's what happened on that score. And then what happened spending power is that he held that, in fact, he held this with the concurrence of seven justices, that the conditions being imposed on Medicaid spending were coercive, unconstitutionally coercive, and this is the first time, as far as I know, since the New Deal, that any conditions based on congressional spending has been held to be both coercive and unconstitutional. But then he said that the remedy for that was not to strike down or invalidate the entire Medicaid provisions, but to say that the Secretary of HHS would not be able to condition existing Medicaid funding on the acceptance of the new program. So states would essentially have a free choice to accept the new funding and expanded program or not accept those things while retaining the original program and receiving the funds for the original program. So before I comment on what I think was gained or lost about that, maybe I'll turn this over to Neil and let him say if he wants to add anything, just by way of description at least, to my summary of the case.
No, I don't think I have much to add, Randy, except I guess I just first want to thank the Federalist Society for putting on this important discussion. And Randy, it's really great to be here with you. I think a real hearty congratulations are in order to you. And I'd say that even if you had lost the case, because you were kind of the intellectual forefather of the whole case, but actually, as I read the decision, and, you know, maybe I might have a different take than you, but I actually think that you won most of what you asked for in this decision. I think that the court's holding on the Commerce Clause does reflect, as you say, much of what you asked for. I mean, you broke it down into three claims. You said that you asked for a limited version of the Commerce Clause, not plenary power, that the courts would enforce those limits, and that the individual mandate was not within those limits. I mean, propositions one and two about a limited Commerce Clause and courts enforcing those limits strike me as non-controversial and really not at issue in the litigation. But item three certainly was, and you won it. And for the third time since the New Deal, you have the Supreme Court saying something transcends the limits of the commerce power. And I know that there were a lot of people who are not members of the Federalist Society who were celebrating last Thursday when they read the decision and or when they read about the decision. But I do think that the kind of ethos of this decision of a kind of muscular Commerce Clause limitation could be something that will turn into fertile ground for litigation. I think that even more so on the Medicaid side, because, as you say, the court held that these restrictions on spending were too coercive, the penalty that states would lose all of their Medicaid funding. And it is, as you say, the first time that such a spending program was determined to be coercive and unconstitutional for that reason. And so I absolutely agree with that. And I think that this, again, will be fertile ground for litigation in the future, that other programs that use the spending power in ways that, and use a stick to take away federal funds will be potentially deemed unconstitutional. And so, you know, I know that the bottom line result for you wasn't what you had hoped for last Thursday, but I think that there is a huge set of victories here if the goal is to limit the power of the Congress of the United States.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to thank you for those kind words. And I want to tell the listeners to this podcast that Neil did just save them up for this Federalist Society podcast, but he very quickly after the decision had a piece in the New York Times, which the Times entitled A Pyrrhic Victory, in which he brings the New York Times readers up to speed on these aspects of the decision. So it's to his credit that he did this right away. And I should also mention that I attended all the Court of Appeals arguments in this case, even before I was a lawyer in the case, and Neil argued all those arguments. And he did a fantastic job doing it. His argument certainly influenced my thinking about the case and how we formulated our arguments going forward, since I thought he gave the statute the best possible defense. And I think he would have done a fantastic job in the Supreme Court had he been the person arguing it. But as it turns out, the government did pretty well anyway. I guess one thing I would just add, I obviously agree with everything that Neil just said. One thing I would add is that there were always two huge issues on the table, which is one of the reasons why the case got so much attention and was deemed so historic. One was the survival or non-survival of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and the other was the affirmation or non-affirmation of the limited powers scheme of the Constitution. As I said, we thought if we got one, we'd get the other. And if we lost one, we'd lose the other. And we never really foresaw that we could lose one and win the other. So what we did is we lost in our effort to Affordable Care Act, which was an important thing we were after. Although we did eliminate the mandatory aspect of the so-called mandate, which is not a mandate anymore, it's now officially an option. So it's not against the law for you to fail to buy health insurance, as we read the statute as saying previous to this. Whether that undercuts the funding mechanism in the same way as just striking down the mandate would have done, we'll have to see. But it is something. And then, of course, the states now have a choice in Medicaid that they didn't previously have. So I think it's fair to say we got basically, 10%, 20% of maybe 25%, if you figure the Medicaid challenge, of what we wanted on the policy front, and we lost 75%. On the constitutional front, I'd say we won 75% of what we were going for on commerce, necessary and proper clause, and spending power, and we lost 25%, which was Chief Justice Roberts' interpretation of the tax power, which is a interesting one and somewhat difficult to know what it's going to mean going forward. But it's a limited reading of the tax power, or at least what he's applying here is a limited reading of the tax power. He's limiting it to taxes that provide an option, incentive, or affect people's behavior, but not that punish them. So he rules out punitive taxes as a means of enforcing limits on inactivity. But that is the bad part of this decision from the legal standpoint, from my perspective, and that is that it allows taxing of inactivity. That is, people can be Congress can put you for failing to do something, which is something that it previously never done before. Let me just add one more bit of perspective about the lawsuit, and I'd be interested to see what Neil's reaction to it is. And that is that if you go back and think perspective on what we gained in this lawsuit and whether the lawsuit was worthwhile, if you go back and ask yourself what would have happened if Congress had written the law exactly the same way as they did previously, but they called the penalty a tax explicitly, I think I know what would have happened. I think that even though we argued that that would still be unconstitutional because it would be a direct tax, et cetera, I think it's pretty safe to say that the lower federal courts would have upheld that tax, even though it was a full, potentially punitive tax on inactivity. And had the law been written that way and had it been upheld by the lower courts, I doubt seriously the Supreme Court would have granted cert on this case. And so 2 years ago, essentially, Obamacare would have been left completely standing, and constitutional law would have been changed for the worse on the lower court level by allowing for penalty taxes. We would not have had what we currently have. We would have not gotten the benefit of this, in my opinion, terrific ruling on the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause, and we would not have had this limited ruling on the tax power. So in a sense, we would have been further behind if that law had been passed the way it currently is standing initially. So we've got the law as currently standing, but we also made some good constitutional law along the way.
So, Randy, I had a couple of reactions to your really interesting points. I mean, I guess I'm a little surprised to say that you think that there was a big statutory win on the Affordable Care Act because it is now a voluntary requirement as opposed to a voluntary thing instead of a mandate. Because as I understood the government's position throughout, it was that it isn't separately illegal if you don't decide to carry individual insurance. Rather, you just have to pay the penalty. And so there wasn't, is at least I thought the government was saying, any sort of separate scheme to say that you were acting illegally apart from the tax power. So I think that itself wasn't a victory very much. But I think that the bigger question for, I'm surprised to say you think you only won 75% of the constitutional things you asked for. I would have pegged it at much closer to 90%. Sure, you didn't win this limited tax argument power here, which didn't frankly seem like where, you know, much of the litigation attention, or indeed even your own kind of intellectualizing of the case, was really, it didn't strike me where the energy was. It was on the kind of limited power of the federal government with respect to the Commerce Clause. And in that, it makes a lot of sense, because it strikes me that the tax power arguments, while interesting and novel, at the end of the day, probably aren't going to really change the landscape of federal legislation very much, if for no other reason than, as your own hypothetical suggests, it's kind of hard to get a tax passed when you call it a tax. And it'll probably also be very hard to do the kind of fancy footwork that Congress did this time in kind of perhaps quasi-calling it a tax, quasi-not, and then relying on the power of the Affordable Care Act. I have to say, I was always a little surprised in the litigation that the lawyers who were challenging this didn't actually make the tax argument part of their affirmative story, precisely in the way that your hypothetical said, because it seems to me that the strong argument that could have been made was, look, we think that there are limited powers under the Commerce Clause. We don't think that they're under the tax power. If you want to pass this as a tax, call it a tax, and you can pass it. And so we're not seeking this kind of judicial activist approach that people are criticizing, because literally the day after June 29th, when the Affordable Care Act is struck down, Congress can pass it again on June 30th, the exact same act. They just have to say explicitly that it is a tax. And that kind of clear statement or second look doctrine kind of strategy, I was always surprised that that wasn't a bigger part of the thinking, because it seemed to me that there was always a kind of two-edged sword for the government when it relied on the tax power.
Well, I think if anyone would know what the government was arguing, you would know what the government was arguing, having made that argument. How many times did you argue in the Court of Appeals?
Too many.
So I'll take your point. I know that's what you said. We always thought that was not a reasonable reading of the statute, and John Roberts' reading of the statute was very similar to ours. I mean, he did find that the requirement part, although an oral argument in the actual Supreme Court case, he was the one that seemed to accept the government's view that the requirement is in no way independent of the penalty, which was what we had been arguing on the Anti-Injunction Act part of it. But he did make a big deal out of it, making it an option and eliminating the mandatory nature of it. So he saw them as separate, the way we saw them as separate, and then he invalidated the requirement part while upholding what you say the government had always been asking for in litigation. And in fact, it was asking that, you know, he did say that he was relying on the government's claim in litigation, that that's what they were asking for. So I agree, and I'm perfectly prepared to say that we won 90% instead of 75%.
I guess I should say that, you know, this is all really early. We don't know where the future goes, but certainly all the people who are celebrating that federal power was reaffirmed in this decision and so on, I think are speaking prematurely, because I do think here are the seeds for the doctrines that I think you really advocated for, you personally in your scholarship and in your writings on the case.
Well, I agree, and when I say I agree with that, what I mean is that what this case means is going to be dictated by future political developments, as cases always are. So what happens in the fall to the Affordable Care Act? What happens in the fall to the presidency and the Senate? What resignations do we get from the Supreme Court? Who are asked to replace them? And whether nominees that are, say, made by a Republican president are asked to say, in this case, which side are you on? Are you on the Chief Justice's side? Or are you on the dissenter's side? I think all of that will, in fact, whichever happens in those eventualities, will play a big role on how this case is ultimately viewed. But I would much, much rather have a very strident affirmation of the doctrinal point that we were making, five justices, than have a huge Wickard versus Filburn on steroid precedent that those of us who want to see limited enumerated federal powers would have to contend with forever, for generations to come. So, yes, I think that's a major part of the case. But I'm very curious about your reaction, Neil, to the saving construction move of the chief. I imagine that you were in agreement with the four concurring justices in their opinion by Justice Ginsburg about how it wasn't necessary to do that. And that would be my guess as to how you would actually have done it if it were Justice Katyal. But I'm wondering what you think about that move. Use of the savings construction move or not?
I mean, I've thought about this move quite a bit, because also a case that I argued, Northwest Austin versus Holder, about the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, basically made the same move. That was an 8-1 decision, again written by the Chief Justice, in which he expanded the statutory meaning of the bailout provision far beyond, frankly, what anyone that I know on either side thought was a really permissible reading in order to save the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. And I do think that, you know, that there is really something to think seriously about for folks in the Federalist Society in particular who really do think hard about the notions of judicial activism and judicial restraint. There is really a kind of worry that when courts are rewriting statutes, they might leave something in place that no one would have ever wanted and that nobody asked for. And those statutes then become really sticky. They become really hard to amend or repeal, particularly if the president likes them, because he can just veto any legislation to alter them, and then you need to have supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. So I'm actually writing a law review article about this now and just about the kind of perniciousness in general of statutory rewriting strategies. With respect to this case, I haven't really done enough thinking to know whether or not this is a permissible reading either on the tax power or on the Medicaid question, in which the Chief Justice says that he'll leave the voluntary piece in but sever the rest out. You know, I do think that a lot of people's natural reaction is, well, that's not as activist as, say, striking down the statute is unconstitutional. And I guess I really wonder whether this is a better alternative, or perhaps a worse one, to leave statutes in place that no one would have ever wanted. And again, I'm not saying that that applies to this particular case of the Affordable Care Act, but in general, it's a move that I think is really worth thinking about.
Well, I think we're nearing the end of our time, Neil, so I guess I want to give you the opportunity to add anything that you want to say before we wrap this thing up.
Nope, nothing for me.
Well, I want to thank the Federal Society also for inviting us both to be here. It's great to be on with my colleague, Neil. It's been a wonderful experience the last 2 years to sort of be on opposite sides of this issue with Neil. One of the things that I said when I was at a public gathering is that no matter who wins this case, Georgetown Law School can't lose, since we've had advocates from Georgetown on both sides of the case. So I think that says a lot about Georgetown Law, where we both teach. And I know that I just admired Neil so much as a colleague, and that admiration only went up greatly when I saw him in action arguing repeatedly in the Court of Appeals.
Well, that's very kind of you, Randy, to say, and it's extremely mutual and heartfelt on my side as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.